Hello, and welcome to Crit Club, a podcast where four friends watch movies from the Criterion Channel streaming service that none of them have seen before, and then discuss them. This week, I'm your host, I am Corey, and with me, as always, is Peter.
Hey, how you doing?
Angela.
Hello.
And Wizard Chris.
Hello.
Hello, everyone. So this week, we are going to be talking about the 1985 film Tampopo. And I'm just kidding. That was a joke. I just want to see y'all's faces.
Oh, that was a good joke.
Yeah, everyone just stared at me.
Rude.
Today, we're going to be talking about the 1996 film. The 1996 film Irma Vep, directed by Olivier Assayas. We're making this accidentally watching the second film from this director that we've talked about on this podcast, as we've already covered his, I believe it was 2008 advertisement for the Musée d'Orsay Summer Hours previously on this show. The film Irma Vep stars Maggie Cheung, who was also in a movie that we've talked about on this podcast before, Police Story. In this one, she's playing a fictionalized version of herself as she is cast into a disorganized French film remake of the 1915 to 1916 era serial Les Vampires. Angela, you can always correct me on my French pronunciations during this episode. The crew of this film...
Bien sûr.
is unstable and chaotic. The already problematic director has a mental breakdown. The critics hate the state of French cinema. This film, in a lot of ways, operates not just as a story, but also as a statement on French cinema, at least how it was perceived in the 1990s. Irma Vep, when it came out, was well received by the critics, and at the time, it was Assayas' international breakthrough hit. The film received a Criterion Collection release in 2021, spine number 1074, and it was later adapted in 2022 to an HBO limited series, also written and directed by Assayas, which was also well received and which I am personally looking forward to watching after this. As always, there are full spoilers for this movie, as we will discuss. You know, I picked this movie because I saw that there had been an HBO remake, and the original just looked like some, I don't know, good old 90s nostalgia. I didn't really even realize that it was the same director as who did Summer Hours. I wasn't really looking at that. I'm glad I didn't notice because I might not have picked it. But I think that it was good that he's a versatile and eclectic director, and he makes a wide variety and assortment of films. So I am looking to talking to you all about this. So, fellow Crit Clubbers, did this movie hypnotize you and put you under its spell? Or did it put you to sleep like a face full of chloroform? Peter, you want to get us started? What did you think of Irma Vep?
We're so good with our intros. We're just knocking it out of the park. It's amazing. 50th episode. Here we go. You went to me first. Okay, so... Yeah, what did I think of this movie? I think I really enjoyed it. Okay, so I did really enjoy it. I think it's 90s as hell. God, what a 90s as hell movie. From everything, from just the graphic design to the music to all sorts of stuff. But I'm a real sucker for this level of just sort of meta-ness and self-commentary. I think I was watching it and definitely enjoying it and liking the sort of real intimate aspects of it. It feels like a very intimate movie in that way of just lots of textural whispering and hushing, and like, you know, the camera movement makes you feel a part of everything. I don't know. I really love how immersed and engrossing this movie felt. I think halfway through I started wondering to myself, but what is this movie about? Like, but what's the purpose of this movie? Like, how is this movie, you know, what am I supposed to be getting, or what is this movie supposed to be saying? And it did, and I think it was right before the great interview with Maggie Cheung and the journalist who I think in the credits is listed as a journalist who loves John Woo. like
Jean-Claude Van
Damme. Journaliste qui aime John Woo is that person's name in the title. And so like as that's when it sort of like broadened to me of like understanding how much of a commentary this was on the state of, as you say very wisely, Corey, of French cinema in the 90s around that. And I really appreciated that, and I looked up a lot. But I think also this is another matter of sort of cultural ignorance around it, despite the fact that I've seen I would say a great number of French movies, and even more through Crit Club. I still don't feel like I'm any sort of expert or even well aware of most of the state and the history around French cinema. And so I think a lot of this commentary wasn't necessarily lost on me, but I think a lot of it was very specific to a very specific audience with a very specific sensibilities that I don't have yet, and I'm interested to sort of learn more about. And so while I connected with this movie in its story and how it told itself, and I think in its playfulness as well, I think this movie was like very playful and fun and creative in a lot of ways, I think the underlying substance of it is something that's going to take more time to really work itself in my psyche, to sort of get out of it what I will ultimately get out of it. More than anything else, I'm just really interested in hearing what you all think. This is like my third movie from Asayas. I think it's Asayas. I don't know. The first one I saw being his most recent, Personal Shopper, which I really did not like. And I think I talked about that in our Summer Hours movie. It's like, I did not like that. And I probably shouldn't have looked up that he did this. But this is maybe my favorite that I've watched by him so far. But I'm just excited to hear what you all have to say. That's my rambling overview.
Very good. Angela, what did you think?
For me, this film is one of those films where I wasn't hugely entertained while watching it, but afterwards I have been endlessly entertained thinking about what I thought of the film and all the nuances of it. I prefer Summer Hours in terms of Asayas's films. I think I feel like Irma Vep is too much. Fly on the wall stuff, and it's very distracting and hard to follow sometimes, even though I like the intimacy of it. I feel like in Summer Hours, he was able to balance that off a little bit more, so that I was more entertained watching it, whereas Irma Vep, I watched it, but with not a ton of pleasure, except for the thing that really captured my imagination was that Maggie Cheung was his partner when he made this movie, mm-hmm. and they were married for a couple of years. I really love that, you know, a lot of directors do movies with their partners in it, but usually the partners are playing a role. So we don't get this intimate look at how the director actually views that person because there's still the veil of the character on the outside. In this film, we actually get to have our cake and eat it too. We get to see the director portray his partner in a role, but also as herself. And you get to see an intimacy there, like in the way that the camera's placed, like you almost get the feeling that you're seeing how the director himself views his partner. And that intimacy was hugely interesting to me. I also liked how much she talked about her challenges in the film industry. And it was like that whole thing where the journalist was interviewing her, that kind of said a lot about what is it actually like to be an actress, an international actress, which I don't think is a story we actually really get to tell. It's very boring. It's a bit mundane and very dramatic. And you're at the whims of all of these creative eccentrics. So I think it's a good movie. I enjoyed it. I was glad I got to watch it. I don't know that I'll watch it again, but I do remember actually as a kid, because this came out when I was 16, 17, and I had just spent time in France. And I remember reading about this in Vogue magazine because all the girls were dressing like this then, like the pale makeup, the dark lip, and the straight hair.
Latex bodysuit.
I'm sure some tried. And I do remember when I was in France, like the vinyl pants were a big thing back in 1995.
Wow.
Which she was kind of wearing the whole 1995 costume with like the jacket with the fuzzy stuff on mm-hmm. the bottoms. Yeah. No, it was. Thank you, Corey, for choosing it. I'm excited what everyone else is going to say. Wizard, that leaves you.
Me? Why, it's me. This was a very cool movie. I had a very fun time watching it. I I'm on the fence. I guess I'm ambivalent about movies, about making movies. I think that, you know, as the journalist kind of pointed out in his interview, he's like, so much of this is gazing at your, you know, your navel. I think that there is a risk when you're making a movie about making a movie, that it's not going to interest anyone that isn't interested in the process of making a movie. And you know, I am interested in the process of making a movie, and I found the process in this film to be interesting, but I thought there was some really, really cool character moments from everybody in this movie. Like, everyone is playing like a slightly like outsized version of themselves, or like a slightly outsized version of like a realistic depiction of an actress, or especially the director character was a huge riot. I had a great time watching him go mad, or like after he watches The Rushes and he's like, this is all shit. I really enjoyed like the characters in this movie about making a movie. And I thought that some of the like the techniques that were used, like I thought the silent film parts of the movie were really enjoyable. I loved the ending. The ending is so like audacious and fun. And again, very 90s, like, I, you know, has that like Sonic Youth video aesthetic. that is, yeah, it was very fun. I had a great time watching this. I thought it was cool. I liked Maggie Cheung's character. I liked her costume designer. I really, really enjoyed kind of her arc throughout the film. Yeah, I don't know. It was cool. It was a cool movie.
Right on. Yeah, I have questions about the ending. We'll obviously get there. I think my first impression.
Corey, I'm fascinated. What did you think?
Yeah. I don't think this is like normally like the kind of a movie that I would like make for myself or like think that I would like, but I really enjoyed it. I think that this. Huh. Obviously, there is a plot here, but like this sort of reminded me of Chan is Missing, where it's like, yes, there's a plot. You're not there necessarily for the plot. You're there for the vibe of the movie. And this was the vibe. I think that there's a lot of, and this is a vibe I could get down with. Like, I liked watching people like chit chat, and I liked the fly on the wall, and, you know, it wouldn't even necessarily like fly on the wall. Like, a lot of it was just like, you're like in there, like POV, just kind of like moving
very intimate
with people and like all that. And it's, you know, and I think that there's a lot of setup in this movie, and a lot of potential for a lot of, you know, tension and conflict and all that stuff. And then it sort of like just kind of just then plays out kind of just like what I would imagine a, you know, French movie would be, where it's like, I don't know, just kind of you know, ends, and there's not a lot of resolution and all that. And
turns out it was ennui all along.
Right. Yeah. And so I feel at one point I paused the movie to like go to the bathroom, and I saw that there were like 20 minutes left, and I'm like, oh, I would like sit here and watch this for another couple of hours. Like, cause it was just like, I was enjoying the, you know, I was entertained. I was, you know, I was there along with the ride with these characters and stuff, and I was following along with it. So I think that them adapting this into a longer serialized version, you know, also made by the, you know, the same writer and director, I think I'm gonna have to check it out, because, you know, there's tension with like the sort of love tension with like, you know, Zoe and Maggie. There's this director who has a nervous breakdown, and then he just kind of like disappears from the movie. So there aren't like these strong character arcs or anything like that. There's nothing like, you know, too, you know, flashy and American, I guess, as they would say, you know, the characters in this movie would say. But, you know, I don't know. I enjoyed it. I liked the vibe of it, and I liked the characters, and there were like funny parts in it too. Like, there were a couple things that just made me, you know, chuckle and stuff. So yeah. Overall, definitely liked the movie. I gotta say, like, the opening shot, I was already like brought into, just to kind of get us talking about sort of the specifics of the movie, where you sort of open up and there's just like this gun, and then that someone like picks it up and moves it, and the, so you're following so along good. Inside in this office to different parts of like someone talking about like to the insurers or whatever about like, you know, getting, making sure they have the insurance or whatever, and then the gun moves over to the lady talking to like funders and trying to get people to like invest in the movie, and then the gun moves over to like the casting, you know, room where like someone's doing a reading and like they're trying to shove the gun, he's like no, get that out. And so like that was just a really cool way to like move you around the office and get you into this and sort of see the like the different scale of the French filmmaking process. Like, I guess because this is like state run, you know, state funded, you know, media, something we do not have in America, that, you know, this isn't like a big blockbuster. This isn't like a big studio thing or whatever. They sort of get these sort of modest budgets and have these like very just office day-to-day type jobs. And in a lot of ways, these are sort of, you know, working schlubs. I mean, the stand-in director that they get at the end, he's like, yeah, my welfare is running out, so, you know, it's kind of like looking for another job. Like, definitely not the glamorous Hollywood director type that, you know, is sort of stereotypical of American, you know, Hollywood scene and stuff. So yeah, I don't know, at the very beginning it sort of
I love that. I mean, because you want to, what a smart decision, because you want to have it set this, you want to tell the story of this process. Wizard, I'm on the other side of what you said. Like, I as I said last week, I love process, mm-hmm. love process. And you know what else I love? Film. Boy, do I love film. And so give me a movie about the making of movies. And I know it's masturbatory, but I absolutely love it.
Corey, masturbatory can be okay, right? I also enjoy a good a good process.
This also reminded me of Living in Oblivion, which I have not seen since I was a teenager in the 90s. But the Steve Buscemi film, also like that came out right at the same time as this, also about film, independent filmmaking, also about production where sort of everything kind of goes wrong and stuff. But I don't know, it just reminded me of that, and I kind of want to like go back and watch that. Nope.
But I think it's super smart of like, okay, you want to set it here. How do you get people are like already leaning forward in their seats? And even though it's a prop gun, the presence of this gun is such a captivating sort of symbol throughout mm-hmm. all of this. Mm-hmm. I thought it was enormously smart and an extremely good way of immediately getting me like, what's paying attention raptly with what's on screen, mm-hmm. what's going to happen to that gun.
Yeah, and also like establishing that they're like just disorganized and like just falling apart.
I kept thinking throughout all of this, maybe it's a little too early to talk about the meta-ness. Maybe we should go through a little bit of what happens within this or what actual whole setup of this is. Well, yeah, because apparently this director, Renee, is hired to remake this classic, this real classic, like you said, Les Vampires. He's captivated by Maggie Cheung and wants to hire her with into this. And I'm really curious about what you all thought of what you felt like his reasons for this, of bringing her in, of what you thought of their initial reactions. Like, I thought that there was a lot of potential sort of metaphor or winking around sort of international influence or sort of the globalization of French cinema within all of this. Mm-hmm. But I'm really curious about how you all took like Maggie Cheung's entrance into this set.
But also that director, do you remember that he's the smarmy guy from Jane V by Agnes?
I looked it up, and he wasn't on. He like I absolutely thought he was, and I looked up his filmography, and it didn't say that it was, or
it's because totally I looked up him.
Specifically for that.
It is.
That's what I thought. Yeah,
it is him, and I laughed out loud when I saw him because like I know him in my mind as smarmy. And so I have to look and see what else he's done. Like, if that's just the role he's played. And so it sort of impacted how I perceived her entrance, you know, and her reactions with him. Like, it seems like he's not that interested in her as an actress as much as her as a sex object.
Is that what you took? Because I wasn't sure about that, because I don't think that was my initial impression about it. I mean, like, I feel like definitely there was some of that, but
this my impression of it.
I see where you're getting
at. My impression of it was all I could think of was the phrase "kill your darlings," and you know, this is a phrase in like writing or art making or whatever, where it's like you have this idea and then you start creating this like larger piece of work, and then when you actually like step back from it, and you look at some of maybe those original ideas or those ideas that were inspiring or got you to the point where you are, but they're no longer cohesive for the actual like thing itself, you got to kill those darlings and you got to get rid of that. And so like, he seemed to have this like really strong image of specifically her, specifically in this outfit doing this thing. Even if I think the whole idea is supposed to be like somewhat satirical, like why would you remake this classic also black and as also black and white and also silent? Like, I can understand taking it and adapting it for a modern audience and, like, you know, sort of putting the story on a new, grander, more modern scale and all that stuff. Obviously, the ending kind of shows what I guess his actual vision was or whatever. But throughout the whole movie, you're kind of like, this doesn't seem like a good idea. And it actually seems like that, you know, non-realistic, navel-gazing type French filmmaking of just like, we're just going to, like, shot by shot remake this silent film as another black and white silent film. Yeah, it seems like maybe this is the reason why French cinema is dying in the 90s, is because of bad ideas like this.
But I mean, like, I don't think it's far-fetched. It didn't seem satirical to me because it was, I just checked, it was 2 years after that the Psycho remake came out.
Which was also a bad idea. But that's a bad idea.
No, yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, no, I agree completely. It was like shot by shot. It was unnecessary. Sorry, Wizard, go ahead.
No, I was thinking of the Psycho remake as well. I was like, how many years out? We're like 2 years out from the Psycho remake, which is a movie that does not need to exist, but does and is kind of an interesting study in navel gazing behavior on the
made
part
by Gus Van Zandt, made by another indie darling Gus Van Zandt.
Go figure. I'm not sure how I feel about like Maggie, sort of like why does the director choose to bring Maggie into make this movie? Like, I believe him when he says, you know, it had to be you. I don't really know why. It's just like, it's the explanation that he provides, and the character strikes me as very, like, you know, he's like that raw, like, open-hearted artist type that, you know, I don't think that there's any reason for him to lie. And I'm not necessarily sure that he views her as a, like, solely as a sex object. I can't remember where he says he saw her initially, which is
some action movie.
Marrakesh.
Yeah. There was like a VHS action movie played.
I think this is in part like a story about a director seized by mania. Like, this is about one film director's manic episode and we're just along for the ride.
Yeah.
You know, which I think is in and of itself a criticism of what I imagine French filmmaking or filmmaking in general, especially if you're driven by like that auteur theory. Like, everybody on this set, all these working class folks are at the mercy of this one guy who had this crazy idea that's not a very good idea. He got some money from the government to do it, and he's like, it has to be her, it has to be like this. And you know, I think that's it. Like, I think he picks her because it has to be her, because he's manic.
Yeah, it's that thing that's stuck in his head, and like, yeah, he has. But I mean, she doesn't even really want to. I mean, she's not like particularly passionate about this.
The second job, Ridley, I mean, Scott
it's, calls, it's just a job
she is
for her.
Up and out.
Yeah, I mean, and like, she even kind of in the interview is kind of like, "What's your character like?" She's like, "I don't know." Like.
But I think it does a really cool job. Like, if this were an American film, or I think about American movies, about making movies, they're often like these like lavish, like big budget productions. And I think the tone of this film is so like working class and like rough that even though we know Maggie Cheung is like an excellent actress and a famous one at that and a successful one, like, This whole movie has this, just throws this like working class veneer on the art of filmmaking. Like, they leave her behind at the studios, they bail. And she seems, yeah, like she's just kind of going through the motions of making a movie that she barely understands because she does not speak French. A few people speak English, but like, she is kind of like being tossed around by all of this, just, you know, in the same way that everybody else is. It's hard to be excited about what is obviously a train wreck of a production.
Yeah.
Angela, what was it? I was just trying to look up real quickly, but I couldn't find out exactly because they're keeping mentions of Les yeux, the fascination, like the fascinating eyes or something. There's like some part of this, and I'm not sure if anybody else knows, like, because there's a book, even like the new director, Jose, like has this copy of this book, and there's lots of talk about like the hypnotic sort of appearance of, is that, Angela, does that ring a bell of like les yeux?
Pas de tout. Yeah, no.
So, okay. So, well, Les Vampires is actually like a 7-hour movie broken up into a bunch of serials. And I think one of the, that's the title of one of the serials, the one where Irma Vep makes her first like real appearance. Incidentally,
yes, hypnotic eyes. Yes. Okay, I'm seeing it.
Incidentally, it's really important that we go over this because Corey did not go over it in his excellent introduction. Irma Vep is an anagram for vampire.
Yeah.
But they are not vampires.
Well, and in case you didn't catch that, they make sure to have the rearranging in the original.
I needed that. I didn't realize that until it came out.
Oh, okay.
But no, but so like, two thoughts of because you're right, Wizard, and I'm seeing it like hypnotic eyes because they kept talking about les yeux hypnotiques or something. And because that was something whenever you would see Maggie Cheung in her full like mask, you know, her full get up and her full mask, like even without knowing that it was hypnotic eyes or whatever, I was completely taken by her eyes and how powerful and like captivating her, like just the beauty and mystery that's like shown in these eyes. Like, I think there was part of me that was like, I see why this director wanted her, because look at these eyes looking back at you. They're so striking and so, you know, compelling. I love the Les Vampires thing. I think I'm getting closer to sort of understanding what this movie is saying about French cinema. I don't know. You think about France being the birthplace of cinema, the Lumiere brothers, right? They invented it, and they, you know, the only sort of silent film I've seen was from France was the Voyage to the Moon, that old Méliès thing. And I really like this idea of maybe sort of what this movie is leaning into. Is that French cinema isn't moving forward. It isn't growing. It isn't expanding. It's retreading. It's like it's old classics in exactly the way you're saying, Corey. And I think this director trying to do that by casting a woman from Hong Kong, you know, trying to break out of that. And then you see what that's with the new director, Jose, being like, what is it, you know, Chinese girl. She's a Paris woman. She should be a Paris woman. Right, and this like rigidity about how French cinema thinks about itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And French culture as a whole. Like some of the worst racism I've actually experienced in my whole life has been Parisians treating Asian Americans really poorly on metro trains. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, it's interesting because just this week, two YouTubers that I really like, Some More News, Cody Johnston, and Patrick Wilhelm, who's a film critic and does these like really long form things about film criticism. But just this week, both of them have talked about like the state of cinema, like currently, and have sort of put a lot of the blame on big action movies that have kind of sucked up all of the time and the resources and all that from all of the sort of smaller stuff. And like, you know, there can't be, you know, sort of Kramer versus Kramer being the biggest movie of the year type stuff anymore, because it all has to be huge bombastic stuff. And so it's interesting to see this, like, you know, especially there was this scene with the interviewer who likes John Woo or whatever, where he's complaining about French cinema not keeping up with the big flashiness of America. And like, he's like, this is what people want. This is like what's like this other French navel gazing is like super boring. And like, just not. And like, he's blaming that on like the sort of the downfalls because they're not keeping up with the bombastic. And whereas now, you know, 30, 40 years later, whatever, like we're sort of having the opposite thing where it's like the bombasticness is taking away the ability to have smaller, quieter, personal stories and, you know, more interesting intellectual type cinema and stuff. So we're almost at a different point now.
I want to talk about the meta-ness of this movie, because I kept thinking about what other movies this reminded me of. And I know that there's like one or two out there that it was not striking to me. And I'm really curious if you all have others that you like that, because it's not as silly or as self-referential as something like JCVD, wherein Jean-Claude Van Damme like imagines himself. Like it's not as surreal as something like adaptation in those ways. But like, I kept thinking of this movie along these lines of like this actor playing herself or playing themselves in these circumstances. Mm. And I don't know if you all have others that came to mind while watching this.
I'm telling you, like Living in Oblivion, like the sort of tone and sort of subject matter is very similar.
I had some like Birdman vibes while I was watching the film. It's not as surreal again, although it does like dip into that. Like she breaks into somebody's house while she's wearing the costume and steals some like comically like thief stealing a jewelry size, stealing a necklace size necklace, like just this like piece of costume jewelry that is straight out of a comic book. She just steals it and leaves. Like that is such a surreal moment in an otherwise fairly grounded movie, and definitely worth talking about. But I think that like, again, like that kind of rougher, like Birdman is about a play, but that kind of process and that kind of, again, like working class vibe where everybody is just trying to get through the day. Film is not this magical thing. It is a pain in the ass job that you have to do to put together. Only the director really gets to feel like film is this incredible art form. Everyone else just has to make sure that they wake up on time and show up on set and get everything done. To answer your question, Peter, I did think of Birdman once or twice, just mm-hmm. in that way.
There's a whole Wikipedia category, films about filmmaking.
Of course.
and I would look up a list of movies of where celebrities play themselves. Mm-hmm. I'm really curious about your all's thoughts around that thieving scene or that burglary scene, because I think it was my favorite mm-hmm. scene of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because there's one aspect we kind of haven't talked a lot about this, which I think was really captivating for me at the first half of it, of just Maggie Cheung being this fish out of water and her place within this. I think there was a lot of, I made a note early on of me not being sure about like what her character or what she wanted or, you know, it was a part of within this whole world that the film was showing. And I think that burglary scene really struck a flag in that character mm-hmm. and who she was in a really dramatic, fascinating way.
Yeah, I think that I wanted more stuff like that in the movie. Like that was actually showing, you know, her going through something and like, you know, taking chances and taking risks and all that stuff. I also liked it.
I liked it because for me, it was like a representation of what is the acting process, right? Like she was struggling when they were filming. And, you know, it seems as though because she did this, she was struggling to really identify with the person that she was portraying. And for me, it's so surreal that it's almost as if like it almost didn't happen. Like it could have been an imagination, even if it wasn't necessarily filmed mm-hmm. that way. It to me, it just represents, you know, exactly how much an actor needs to get into the skin of their character to really do the best job. Mm. I think it's one of the best cinematic approximations of that process. Like it's not the rehearsing your lines in your trailer. It's not taking notes from your director. It's like, you know, in this case, physically actually becoming a criminal and stealing something and, you know, getting into that mindset. But we know that most actors are not actually taking it that far. They are maybe doing a more emotional, visual version of this. And even in some cases, like finding their own emotional resonance within a character through their own experiences. Another note from that scene, though, was like the extreme nudity, not extreme, but there was like I can't remember the last movie where I saw like, what, 5 minutes of bush. And it was interesting to me because the Irma Vep character was like head to toe latex. And that's contrasted with this completely nude woman. And I don't know, I just found that fascinating. And maybe someone else has deeper mm-hmm. thoughts on it than I do.
Well, I also, you know, I like the scene, but it also feels like, now looking back at it, like another thing that this movie kind of sets up but then doesn't really come back to, or just, you know, it doesn't really follow through on. Like, after sort of this example, there's no other thing that really happens. Like, it's almost like setting up, like, she's going to have to, like, go to these extreme measures to sort of get into this character or to have this movie created or whatever and stuff. Nah, that's not really what happens. It's just kind of feel like another just sort of vignette within this, you know, sort of series of vignettes or whatever.
She's just so good. She only needs to do it the one time. Right. Sure, you know? Sure. She's like, all right, I got one this. Take. It's important to remember that, like, it's a silent film and everything is motion, and she has no lines, and so I kind of don't need anything from that scene. If it is a scene that actually happened, or, like, you know, it's like a surreal moment in a film, so it doesn't, the fact of it doesn't matter too much, but, like, this scene of her, yeah, as Angela says, like, embodying the character and getting in her head. Like, later when they ask about her character, or when she's talking to the director about her character, she's like, oh, she's, like, courageous, maybe, or brave. Like, she doesn't seem to have a good sense of the character.
And he's just like, no, she fucks.
She fucks and gets fucked. Oh, my God.
God.
But, like, I think that scene absolutely, like, establishes, like, this is how you can mine a character with no lines through a purely physical performance and embody, like, that, I don't know, that cool-ass attitude of being a masked European jewel thief. They're all over the place. It's so exciting.
I agree with you all, and Angela, you said it really well, I think, about embodying this role. I also, this movie did this a couple times where I was having this thought about a specific theme or a character, and that it answered my thoughts as if it were reading my thoughts. But it was, you know, right after I'm wondering, what is Maggie Cheung's, who is she in this? What does she want? What are her desires? Like, who is this character? And then me sort of ruminating on the fish out of water scene. Another thing I took from that burglary scene is her trying to find a place. Like, her place is in the role, you know, like, she's doing this, you know, this absurd, mm-hmm. you know, illegal action to feel like she belongs somewhere in this city, in this country, by inhabiting this role, and there's where she belongs. And that made me enormously, not that I wasn't sympathetic to her before, but that made me know her and feel connected to her, like, far more than I previously had. Mm-hmm. Yeah, great nudity. Great,
really,
you know, like,
really great nudity.
Bearing her soul, she was having a very tense conversation. It made sense that she'd be naked.
And like, that whole conflict just over the phone, like, I just thought it was just good, really funny. Like, this guy bought her a ticket to Paris and then didn't come to meet her there and stuff. I don't know. I want to know more about that. That's good.
That's
stuff.
A dick move.
Yeah, shameful. Real dick move.
And now she's lost her piece of costume jewelry that was maybe worthless, but maybe not.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but that also, what I liked about it was that it seems to me more realistic representation of female nudity. Like, usually in film, it's, you know, everything is so staged and you're posed. Mm-hmm. Like, that looks like how naked women hang out. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, and she did a good, like, she was just, like, visibly upset. And she was, like, get up on the bed and then just, like, get down on the floor and then get up. Because she just, like, had anxious energy and stuff. I mean, she was definitely doing a good job. There was a moment. Oh, gosh, I'm going to have to look through my notes. Because there was a moment when, like, Maggie really sold me on, like, what a good actor she was. And it is,
I
want to
know what
to
she's doing
here.
Now. Like,
she,
like,
disappeared from public life in the early 2000s and just doesn't come around. Doesn't give interviews. Yeah. You know, she's been sort of hidden for, like, the last, you know, close to 20 years or so.
Hmm.
Here's a question.
She was in a deleted scene of Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah. This is a total aside. This is something I've wondered my whole life, even as a little kid. When people were acting in silent movies, were they being silent?
Or were they're mouthing, like, lines and stuff.
They were actually like play acting and all that, just making sure.
Yeah, they're doing the thing. Did anybody watch any part of the original Les Vampires There's
all 7 hours.
All 7 hours.
Just kidding.
But did anybody catch any of those episodes? There's one on the Criterion Collection, and because the movie is like 1,000 years old, it is also available like in completion online. Mm-hmm. I love like silent movies. I love the aesthetic and like the overacting and this like very like delicate thing that is acting on film that exists at this time, because everybody's trying to figure out how to do it, right? I watched a little bit of them. I watched Irma Vep's first appearance. They're like super trashy. They're very fun. Like the first episode is called The Severed Head, and it's about a guy who got his head cut off, but the head is missing. And I read a little bit about the movies, and like these are movies that critics, when they came out, critics hated them. These were like, this is immoral trash. This is undeserving of being
a severed head. Why I never.
And audiences fucking loved these movies. They loved that it's about gangsters, this like international intrigue and jewel thieves, and like cool like these are like proto thrillers, right? And like, without having the context, like the complete context of what this film, what these films kind of the role they play in French cinema, it's hard for me to really appreciate like the meta quality of doing Les Vampires. But just like that tension between critics and audiences, that like the quintessential Frenchness of these silent films, I really enjoyed like thinking about that and thinking about how the movie kind of goes over that theme, even if, you know, again, I'm not able to necessarily appreciate exactly what Irma Vep means to French folks at large, other than they don't want her played by an Asian actress, which is pretty fucked up.
Yeah. I think I really enjoyed was, and I think this is just Asayas in general, because I think this is in Summer Hours as well, is just the scene choice of how we don't get any of the big moments. Like, we don't get any of the big confrontations or the big decision things. It's all sort of like the quiet aftermath of it. Mm. And I think that is just it's something I just really enjoy and really love.
Well, and speaking of quiet, this is sort of like more of like the style of it. There's even a line that he says about silence, like silence is, I can't remember what it is now, but there are scenes in this movie where there's like, you know, 10 people all talking at once, and they're just like, and the scene stretches on. I mean, the scenes in this movie are long, you know. I don't think there's even like as many distinct scenes in this movie as there are in most movies. It's probably, I would say, a third or a half or whatever of the actual like sort of number of scenes where you're actually cutting to somewhere else, because the scenes just kind of like move along, and there's these just a lot of people chattering away, and then all of a sudden you're watching 2 or 3 minutes of a silent movie, and it's just like silent, and like, or you're watching them film a silent movie, or you're watching the old silent movie. And so it's this like interesting contrast of loud chatter, constant moving, blah blah, blah, to just like silence. And then I really liked the scenes. And he does it a couple times where it's like you'll just be watching a scene, and then you realize that like what you're watching is other people watching that. You know, like you'll be watching this like long scene of a thing, and then all of a sudden you realize, oh, it's them sitting there watching the rushes or the dailies or whatever of, you know, the shot or whatever. And I don't know, I really liked that. It gave a break. It gave like sort of breathing room from the sort of like constant chatter and like interactions of the characters to, you know, just having some silence and stuff. And then I don't know once you got tired of it, then it would just like bring you back in by like having the other people like watching what you were watching and stuff. It makes you feel like a participant. It makes you feel like you were either in the room or you're like participating along with them and stuff. Like, I don't know. There's a lot of like subtle style things in this, like even beyond sort of the bigger bombastic sort of stylistic choices with this.
When Rene, the director, has his like big breakdown after watching The Rushes, he says something to the effect of, they're just images about images. Mm-hmm. And that's like the thesis of the movie. That's the thesis of the movie in a nutshell. This movie is a movie about a silent film. Like, this is the way the ending like becomes his own like art film. Like, the whole movie is a movie about about images and mm-hmm. how we process them, like us as the audience, us as the film crew. That yeah. character was so great. I love this.
Yeah, and like that's also another example of like them not showing something too. It's like you don't see his breakdown at all. I mean, you see hints of it obviously or whatever, but like you don't actually see the big thing. You just, you know, see the
aftermath. She goes and the police are there.
Yeah. <It's>... Yeah. And it's also like, I don't know, it's made me think a lot about just kind of like the privileges and stuff. It's like, you know, if he were just some lower class nobody or whatever who was like thrashing around and threatening his wife and all that stuff, like probably wouldn't be getting like the sort of soft hand, you know, feather touch from the firemen or whatever. He'd probably just hauled off to jail.
I would argue that this illustrates a fundamental difference in American versus French policing.
Maybe
like,
that's it.
They're like, let's talk to a doctor. Let's get you a sedative. You're obviously agitated. They call the firemen before they call the police, which mm-hmm. was something that I am still thinking about. I'm like, is that true? Do you call the firemen first? Do you call police if there's like a potential for violence or something? Like, how does that work?
Here in Portland, the firemen always arrive first for some reason. It's because right now we're understaffed with cops. Mm. And at this point, actually, because of the fentanyl crisis, the firemen are getting attacked by belligerent addicts. And so the firemen are almost like ready to strike to get the cops to actually like staff up or something.
Yeah, I mean, that's who showed up and I got in my bike wreck.
Physical fitness requirements that police don't.
Yeah, that's true. When do we get to talk about the end of the movie?
Yeah, I mean, let's get to
it.
But before we get to like,
go for it, Angela. What did you think?
We get to the end, I just want to talk about like the switch to the directors. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I really liked the character of the new director.
So
I don't agree with
hilarious.
Yeah. I don't necessarily like agree with that guy or
the two
I hang
types
out
of
with
French
him.
Directors.
Yeah. Yeah. But I loved the contrast.
The two genders.
Yeah. Right. Like just this total like schlubby neckbeard type dude just that comes in and is like all matter of facty and stuff. And just I don't know. I love the fact that he was just kind of like he was just doing nothing, living off the government dole for a while until it's like, running out of money. And I guess I should take another filmmaking job. It's just like,
I love the idea of just in Paris right now, there's a bunch of directors like stacked up at the welfare line.
Mm-hmm.
Just got to collect a check today.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll direct a movie next month.
Yep. But yeah.
I have something to say about the director, but it goes with the ending as well. So I'm ready to end to talk about endings.
Okay.
And I want to hear what Angela's thoughts on endings.
Oh man. So at the end, you know, the directors changed hands. We find out that everything is going to change with this movie. And so they watch the edited rushes from the last couple of days to see sort of what is this movie? What are they actually even making? And it's my favorite part of the movie.
Oh like, yeah.
What they ended up making was beautiful and amazing. Mm-hmm. And now I know why at film school people were like, you should watch Irma Vep, because a lot of my little weird projects had I would scratch into the film to animate things in it. Mm-hmm. And so for me, watching this movie was like, hey, I am very happy I didn't end up in the film industry because it seems horrible. But those beautiful, the things you end up making it worth it. But no one is ever going to see all of these beautiful shots of Maggie Cheung and how she moved on the screen. You kind of finally got an idea of what this director was trying to do and what is only possible with the work of a team, right? Like you really get an understanding that you can't tell how that movie is going to go in the production until you see that final product. And that you can't take like too much responsibility yourself or credit. For the final output.
Yeah, and I think that it was sort of it was a good reversal because I was going through the whole movie of like, this is such a bad idea for them to be just like remaking a silent version of a silent movie and all that stuff. Yeah, and then seeing what the actual thing was, it's like, oh, I would watch that. Like, you know, like, and it's almost like, you know, you're along with like, oh yeah, totally, I'm with you. French cinema is dying or whatever. And then you see that and it's like, oh, well, okay, that's funny. No, it's
It'll
not.
It'll probably
like,
be fine.
I don't know.
But then at the same time, like, is it like what we're watching is not
narrative?
It's not narrative, but does it fall into the same does it fall into the same vein as other French cinema that is like navel-gazy and like relevant only to the person that made it? Like, can you decipher any meaning? Like, those are beautiful images, but can you decipher any meaning from them necessarily? And I'm not saying that like with art there has to be like that has to be something that you get out of it, but within the context of the film where we have this character who is like, French film is too personal and too solipsistic, what was that?
I would say two things to that.
It was rebelliousness. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I would, it was rebellion.
Go ahead.
I would say that he wasn't finished, number one.
True.
And
true.
Number two, I think this movie only takes place over the course of like 3 or 4 days. I don't know how he did all this editing and scratching into the film over the course of 3 or 4 days.
That's how he always does it.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, he did it at night. That's right. He was always editing at night. Yeah. So one thing I found really fascinating is the character of, I guess, Laura, the stunt woman who's brought in, you know, and then, you know, that's how we meet the new director as he's interviewing, he's like giving her the Irma Vep role. And the last thing we hear him say is that she's going to be replaced, is that he's already replacing her. Like, I really, for some reason, loved that last line of this new director because it sort of just like propels, you can sort of stretch out this movie and see how the cog and the machinery is just going to keep grinding and grinding and grinding away long after this movie is over. And I really, it was such a subtle little tiny thing that I actually watched twice just because I wanted to make sure I knew who he was talking about, but I really thought that it was just another brilliant touch of just sort of like propelling the story for the forward. You don't need, you know, I would have loved another 40 minutes, but you don't need it because you can see where this machine takes you and takes the people that are caught up in it.
And I almost had to do a double take with like the Laura character especially at the cafe. Like, it wasn't even so much with her before she was the stunt double. When she came into that cafe, there was something about that shot that I was like, wait, is that Jane Birkin? I was like, no, it's not. But like, she just had Jane Birkin vibes to her. So
they need a Jane Birkin type to play Irma Vep.
Right. Yeah.
I do think we should also, at least I would like to personally shout out, Maggie Cheung was incredible, but also I did love the costume designer, her portrayal.
Yeah,
like
so
I
good.
Thought, yeah, just wanted to give one more shout out to her because I thought she was incredible throughout all of this. And I think she brought a whole lot of pathos and emotion and realism to that role.
You know, as you mentioned that, like, now we're talking about like three different women who were really treated poorly on this film shoot. The message for me in this takeaway is just how horrible it is and probably still is to be a woman on a film set. It's awful. Can confirm.
Yeah.
What did you think of her acting in this role?
Fantastic. Like, however, like, it is surprising to me that she is the costumer on this because she's so erratic. And generally speaking, like, film sets don't like, or like, you need to just show up and do your job. Like, the other bullshit, like, she would have gotten fired. I loved her. She was great. She isn't allowed to be her, you know, she's just being herself. But, she must be a really good seamstress.
What do we think?
I loved that the beginning. I love going to the sex shop.
And I love the exhalation of cigarette because I was even like, wait, did she just like puff a cigarette before it? And then just the smoke comes out of the mask.
Yeah, so funny.
What do we think about the ending? She dumps her bag though to
find the drugs. I thought that was really interesting because it's something that Jane did in her movie as well.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, raise your hand if you've been to a 1990s rave.
No, they look great. They look about the same as the 2020s ones.
Right.
Fashion has improved somewhat, perhaps, but that's about it.
Yeah, I don't know. Again, like the end of this arc with, you know, Maggie and Zoe and all that stuff, they take this taxi out to this rave or, you know, party or whatever and stuff. And then just kind of Maggie just like changes her mind. It's like, no, and it's kind of like, I don't know. It just seems very, I don't know, French kind of an ending to this like tension and arc or whatever.
I think at that point,
that satisfying?
Yeah. Did you find that satisfying?
I was sort of hoping that, and just to tie like some other arcs together, I was hoping that like Maggie would have like stolen her drugs or something. Like she sold the necklace or whatever. Because when she was like emptying her purse, I was like, oh yeah, did Maggie steal something from her? And it was like, but that now that just ended up not being it. That would be overriding in the context of this. Yeah, that would be overriding in the context of this movie. So,
like, I think at that point in the film, Maggie knows that she's not going to be working on the film anymore. Because the next day when they watch The Rushes, we understand that she's flown to New York. She's going to go talk to Ridley Scott and do something cool with him, maybe. So it's a frustrating ending, but I think it reflects the reality of working in film, working on a film set. Like, this is a gig, and maybe part of what I like to think that part of what's going on in Maggie's head is like this desire maybe to be closer to this person, but this understanding that this is like a temporary thing, and I don't want to. This means more to Zoe, I believe her name. This means more to her than it does to me, and I don't feel good about that. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting character.
I thought about it in terms of again this theme of fish out of water and trying to find a place within this country. I agree with you, Wizard, of wanting to find the place, but knowing that Zoe wanted something that she couldn't give, and just deciding that as much as she wants to find a place or is looking for a place, this isn't the place for her.
Yeah.
And so she's just rather peace out, as that seems to be the best thing for everyone. I did love how the family, how the movie handled Zoe's queerness as well.
Mm-hmm. 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 Very French.
Mm. Oui, oui.
All right. Well, is there anything else anyone wants to say about Irma Vep, or should we have been saying Irma Wep? Before we start getting to ratings,
man, fascinating movie. Yeah, thanks, really Corey.
Good choice.
This is good choice. Good 90s shit.
All right.
Good 90s. You gotta love that grainy film stock. That's how you know. That's how you know you're
Sonic
and the VHS. And, all right. Well, on this podcast, when we do our ratings, we like to do things a little differently, and we rate things from 1 to 20 as a nod to rolling the 20-sided die in role playing games. So let's go in the same order as we did the introductions. Peter, what are you rolling for Irma Vep?
Man, it's a tough one with this one because I unabashedly liked it. And I think our conversation fleshed out a lot of those things I talked about in my introduction, and helped me really understand more about the themes and what this movie was trying to do, but also what I got from it. That being said, I'm not sure that this is something that will live long in my head. I'll think about it from time to time, but I think this is something I'm glad to have watched and know about, rather than something that maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it will stick well with me. I don't know. I'm thinking 15, and I think that that's a nice. I'm like between 14 and 15 on this, I think the ending, while I was fine, I think I was happy with a lot of where it landed. I think it still felt a bit flat. Not that I wanted more plot or that I wanted more anything. I think there were parts of like the last 20 minutes that felt a little rushed, and it felt like things were wrapped up quicker in a way that left me feeling a little bit unsatisfied. But I don't know what I would change about it. So I don't know, 14, 15. I think 15, maybe I'll change it to 14. 15.
Okay, very good. How about you, Angela?
Oh, Peter, you messed up my scoring here, my rolling on this, because I was like between a 13 and a 14, leaning towards a 13. You're at 15, right?
I think so, yeah.
Because I liked it, I didn't love it, but I didn't hate it. I thought it was interesting. I think it's an important French film for sure. So I am going to go 14. 14. Yeah.
Okay. 14 from Angela. Yeah. How about you, Wizard?
This is 16 from me. It was a cool movie. I had a fun time. Nice. There were some striking images and some fun stuff here. I will forget one day, perhaps, the magic of Irma Vep, but not for a while. It was fun.
All right, very good. Yeah.
Corey, what about you?
I think I'm sort of on the same page with all you all. I was kind of like bouncing around between, so sort of the same range. So I think I'm going to go with like 15 myself. I think this might be one of our closer bunchings of scores we've ever done here.
It is when it's not like the highest high or the lowest low.
Yeah, like Sandro or something where we all gave it like 19. Like, yeah.
This may be the only time we've been in the middle stages middle all bunching. Grouped in together. That's wonderful.
Interesting. What a surprise.
Yeah. Well, we would love to know what you thought about Irma Vep or any of the other stuff that we've watched on this podcast. You can reach us at critclubpodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. So for our next episode, I think we're going to do something a little differently just to sort of celebrate kind of the 3 years or so that we've been doing this podcast. Peter, I'm going to hand it off to you just to give a little description about what the next episode is going to be like.
Okay, I'll grab that microphone. Yeah, next, this is, Corey, you had the honor of leading us through our 50th episode of the Crit Club's 50th episode. And while maybe that's not as many as other podcasts have done, for us, this has been a span of over 3 years because we started this in late summer 2020, and we decided that it would be an excellent occasion to mark that milestone with a 50th episode spectacular titled And what that means is I am taking it under myself to finally pull together all of the scores of all 50 of these episodes into one paper of record spreadsheet. And we're going to spend a big chunk of time on the next episode talking through the 50 episodes, the movies that we've watched together, some of the highlights, some of the lowlights, movies that have stuck with us, movies that haven't so much as we thought, and any sort of else, other thing that kind of, that crawls into our head. We're also going to talk about what are some of the other things. Looking ahead, what sort of movies or directors or eras or stories we'd like to learn more about. We're going to talk about forbidden picks, things that we wished we would have picked to share with this group and this podcast, but because of our strict rules where we all have to come to it new, that we were unable, and maybe some surprising things along the way. But we'll be there, and we really hope you all join us for our 51st episode, which will be the big milestone thing. Yeah. Should I talk about the movie after that, what we'll watch? Because it's my pick.
Yeah,
I don't
know if
you'll
I just say that I'm looking forward to it. I think there are a number of movies that I think I'm interested in like revisiting my scores on, maybe not officially, but at least somewhat. And it'll be a nice numberlistic experience for all of us, a little bit of our own navel-gazing of our own.
It's meta.
Yeah. It's so meta. And then after that, the next episode after that will be my pick, and it will still be in spooky season, and I've decided to go with Ingmar Bergman's 1968 movie Hour of the Wolf. I don't know anything about it. I've got the Wikipedia page up here now in front of me, and I'm refusing to read more than the first half of the first sentence just because I know zero about it. I think the reasons I want to go into this is I have only seen one Ingmar. I think I've only seen one Bergman film, The Seventh Seal. I really want to watch more of him. I don't know if Hour of the Wolf is about werewolves, but I absolutely love werewolves. And I don't know, it seems like something cool and interesting to watch. So we'll mention this again after the next episode, but for the next movie that we'll all be discussing, it will be Ingmar Bergman's 1968 Swedish psychological horror film, Hour of the Wolf.
Very good. Looking forward to it. I've never seen an Ingmar Bergman film, so this will be my first. Very good. And so that closes sort of the main part of the podcast. And we usually close out by talking about the other stuff that we are also watching or reading or playing or doing or whatever. So, Peter, what else you been watching lately?
Ah, back to me. Talking a lot. Sorry, everyone. Two quick things because we're in October now, and I've been a little slacking. I had to take a quick surprise trip to Maine this weekend, so I wasn't able to watch as many horror films as I would have wanted. But I have watched two horror films over the weekend worth mentioning. The first is the new VHS found footage movie dropped on Shudder. It's called VHS 85. And what is this, the fifth one? I think maybe the sixth one of the VHS series.
It's not the 85th.
All found footage horror movies. It's not the 85th. It just takes place in 1985. And I'm just an unabashed fan of found footage horror. I think it's far better than it should be most of the time. And I think the majority of them are good and solid. And I think it's a great milieu for horror to take place and capture your mind. I think these anthology VHS movies are very hit or miss. And I think the newest one is maybe not as good as the first and second one, but up there. The second horror movie, even though it's not necessarily a horror movie, but I went to a screening of 2016's The Love Witch.
Hey,
has anyone seen The Love Witch?
Yeah, The Love Witch is great. It's sumptuous.
Yeah. Angela, have you ever seen this or heard of this?
Is it a horror movie?
It's
not really.
No.
Oh, I've seen this. I'm like, this sounds familiar. Yes, yes, I have seen
it. I have not. Should I see it?
I think you'd really enjoy it. I think there's a lot that you'd really get out of The Love Witch.
All right. That tracks.
It's silly. It's really silly.
Yes.
Okay. I like silly.
Written and directed by Anna Biller. Written and directed by Anna Biller. Everyone else. A witch, a newly christened witch, moves her life. She says to the redwoods. I'm not sure where that is.
Of course, it is the redwoods.
Arcata. I think it's in like Northern California. Yeah.
Oh yeah, yeah. And proceeds to love a couple men to death. I guess not anachronistic. Like it's definitely going for a 1950s, 1960s thing.
Campy,
but also very winking.
Like, yeah,
yeah, very campy. And I think it nails that tone so well. And I just think that the star, Samantha Robinson, she is spectacular. Like I think she has a comedic sensibility that she plays that role with in a way that like I was laughing out loud because of a tone of a word that she said. Like I think this was just a real fun and entertaining movie. I knew I wanted to see it. I remember when it came out. I remember seeing trailers, but I just never made the time. And so I'm glad I got to see a screening of it at my local Cinemaplex. Those are my two things.
I would totally do that.
Watch it, Angela.
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah, I think you'd enjoy it. It's goofy as hell, and I think you'd pick up what it's putting down.
Oh fuck yeah!
Well, instead of just stuff that Angela should watch, Angela, what have you been watching?
Nice
guys. I'm a little ashamed because I completely binged over 48 hours the entirety of the Beckham documentary on Netflix. I don't watch soccer. What the hell is wrong with me? I don't know, but I found it very compelling. It was like low stakes.
So not Victoria Beckham.
Both of them. You have like two Beckhams in there telling like the whole story of all the various like controversies. I don't know why I liked it. I blame Netflix. They make all the trailers run as you're trying to pick things. And I was just sucked in by stuff that Victoria Beckham says. She casts a spell on people, that lady.
I don't know who these people are or anything about them, but I did see a clip going around about Victoria Beckham. Like it was just like a little snap of her being
Sporty
like,
she's posh spice. Oh, it's posh spice.
Oh, posh spice.
I'm so sorry.
Posh
sorry, listen.
She's just like,
I'm so sorry, listen.
if it hadn't done enough to do it, you have to refer it back to the 90s. That's when my like I stopped forming new memories. She was like, we were very working class, and the guy's like, no, what did your dad drive? What did your dad drive you to school? And blah, blah, blah. And she's like, a Rolls Royce. And he's like, yeah. I just saw a clip of that. Is that what this is from?
Yes, it's okay, from that. She also talks about what it's like being Beckham's girlfriend when they're all singing Posh Spice takes it up the ass. Like, imagine a stadium of 80,000 people. Singing that, and you're that person, and you're having to talk to some dignitary next to you. It's very weird and awkward. I sort of enjoyed watching it. What else am I watching?
Monster.
Yeah, that's right. There's this weird movie called Eiffel, which imagines what it would have been like if the guy who made the Eiffel Tower was like super hot and had an affair. He did neither of those things. Was neither of those things.
Sexy Eiffel Tower movie.
I love this.
And so it was a nice, you know, very romantic movie. I thought it was French. It's a French film in French language. And I'm just like, how much more French can you get where we're like, we love this Eiffel Tower so much. We're going to just create a love story around it that didn't actually happen. It was watchable.
I love it so much.
Also did Power a rewatch cinema. Of Age of Innocence, Martin Scorsese film. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I could actually hear the dialogue this time. But such a...
Are you excited about Killers of the Flower Moon, Angela?
I am. I am, actually. But I haven't watched a lot of Scorsese lately just because I'm more like...
It's bad.
Is it bad?
Because you don't... Who has the time?
I don't... Like 4 hours long. I don't want this to turn into a
I watched The Irishman because it was 2020.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm in quarantine. I could watch it. Yeah.
No, but one final thing to share is that I have a favorite Instagram account right now. Which is Long Lost Personals, which shows personal ads like dating back to like the 1930s, 40s, 50s. It's weird as fuck and, you know, slightly perverted. Nice. Major recommend fun times. Like,
seeking
you know,
a gal with great gams.
Right? It's like we did not invent sex, everybody. Just FYI.
Very good.
So that's what I'm watching.
How about you, Wizard?
You know, I have not had a ton of time to really watch much of anything this week. It's been a very, very busy week, and I have kind of chosen to fill what little free time that I have between work and various projects with a little game called Baldur's Gate, which is still fun, still great. Hey. I have restarted the campaign with I was originally a human barbarian. Now I'm giving a drow monk a shot. I think that'll be kind of fun. I will do this several times before I either power through and finish the game or put it down and never pick it up again. And only time will tell which is which.
Interesting.
Corey, what else are you watching?
Corey, what are you watching?
So I got hit with the COVID vaccine really hard. And I was just like, all weekend, I was like just laying around with a fever and stuff. And so I have like piled up on HBO Max, like, they've put on all these like horrible Stephen King movies from the 1980s that I just had added to my list because I'm like, I've never actually seen these. I mean, I love Stephen King. He's made some of my favorite stuff or whatever. And I watched
Overdrive. Please say yeah. Maximum Overdrive.
No, I watched Silver Bullet starring Gary Busey and
Gary Busey.
Yeah, Corey Haim. Yeah. And it was absolutely terrible. It was just a horrible movie. And it was just, I don't know, kind of what I was in the mood for watching just a terrible B movie. So. As much as I do love a lot of the things of from Stephen King, I definitely do not love his entire oeuvre.
Those inexpensive Stephen King movies from the like 80s, like early 90s, there's some gems in there. Thinner is a pretty great movie, but for every Thinner, there's like a Sleepwalkers. You're like, this is not a very
That was also
movie.
On the list. I tried to start watching Graveyard Shift, and I'm just like, this is too bad. I can't do it.
Have you seen the other half? Have you seen Christopher Walken's?
That's also, I think, on
the
there.
Other half starring Chris Walken.
Yeah, all right.
Ooh, boy, that's a very fun Christopher Walken performance.
Very good,
very unhinged movie.
Frida and I rewatched Memento, which neither of us had seen in a long time, and it's still great. It's great.
How does it hold up?
It's just like Nolan. it's a gimmick that like no one else is gonna ever be able to do. Like you just can't do it because you'll always be compared to Memento, but it does it so well, and I don't know. I don't want to spoil, I guess, this, like, you know, what, 30-year-old movie, 20-year-old movie. But he does stuff in it that is, like, just very, very, it's clever beyond just its gimmick, I guess. It's a good movie. I really enjoyed it.
Christopher Nolan is Hollywood's cleverest boy.
Yeah, right. And then
pat him on the head with your ticket sales.
Yeah. And then I don't know, I finally watched Mr. America. That is where I am in the On Cinema watching universe. This was a theatrically released movie that they started off as like just a little web thing about Tim Heidecker running as DA of San Bernardino County because he got sued and he didn't like the fact that he got sued, even though there was a mistrial and he actually ended up going to jail. So it's him trying to unseat the DA who was, you know, prosecuting him and stuff. And they try to give you some backstory in this movie and they show clips of other stuff. But like, there's no way that anyone should be going to watch this in a theater without having previously watched the previous 10 years of On Cinema stuff. So just, I don't know. I liked it. It was really funny. I mean, Frida watched it with me and she was also laughing, but I was also having to like pause and explain stuff and be like, this is why this is really funny. And this is why I'm cracking up at this scene and probably no one else is, because, you know, there's, you know, so much going on in it. So I obviously watched the previous 10 years of stuff first and then watched Mr. America. But that's where I am now. And I believe that I'm moving on to now a new season of On Cinema. So I'm still working through getting through that entire thing. All right. I think that's going to wrap us up for this episode of Crit Club. Thank you, everyone, for coming along this journey with us.
Where can people talk to us?
Yeah.
Where can people reach out to us and talk
Instagram,
to us?
Instagram, Crit Club Podcast, Gmail, Crit Club Podcast at gmail.com. We're on Threads, kind of. Mm-hmm. Like, someone say something to us, I'll respond.
Still waiting on that Blue Sky invite. But yeah, reach out. We'd love to hear from you. Otherwise, we will talk to you next time when we have our 51st episode spectacular.
Whee.
Yeah.
Woo.
See y'all next time.
Irma Fett means vampire.
Thumb.
Mix around letters.
Vampire.
It's lay vampire people. I was dumb.
Bye.
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 Bonsoir.
Bonsoir.
A tout à l'heure.